Production. Recorded live.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Talking Twilight Zone.
You open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination. And you're invited along. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be talking Twilight Zone.
Yes, indeed, everyone. This is the latest episode of Talking Twilight Zone. My name is Lynn, and I'm joined today by my co-hosts, Bobby Neer, Kelly, Ken, and Robert. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hello.
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 Okay, today we are going to pick apart our latest Twilight Zone episode of Stop at Willoughby, considered by many to be a classic or very close to a classic. And before I give my summary of the show, I would like to turn this over to Robert for his opening clip. There you go, Robert.
And now, Mr. Serling. This is Gart Williams, age 38. A man protected by a suit of armor all held together by one bolt. Just a moment ago, someone removed the bolt, and Mr. Williams' protection fell away from him and left him a naked target. He's been cannonaded this afternoon by all the enemies of his life. His insecurity has shelled him. His sensitivity has straddled him with humiliation. His deep-rooted disquiet about his own worth has zeroed in on him, landed on target, and blown him apart. Mr. Gart Williams, ad agency exec, who in just a moment will move into the Twilight Zone in a desperate search for survival.
Back to you, Lynn.
Well, thanks for that, Robert. Okay, well, A Stop at Willoughby depicts a man named Gart Williams who is living a horrible life. Now, his job is an account executive for what seems to be an advertising agency, I guess, is very stressful because he works for a tyrant of a boss. The episode starts out with him sitting in a meeting with his boss and other executives when he finds out that he's lost a very lucrative account. So his boss starts screaming at him, and Gart loses it and calls him fat boy and tells him to shut up. The rotten boss forgives him and lets him keep his job. However, on his train ride home, Gart falls asleep and dreams that a train conductor is yelling out, Willoughby! Willoughby! Gart looks out the window and sees a very serene and peaceful town that seems to be just where he wants to be. He asks the conductor just where he is. What is Willoughby? And the conductor says, it's a place where a man can slow down to a walk and live his life full measure. He then wakes up and realizes he was dreaming. Sort of. He goes home. And his horrible wife tells him that she knows about his outburst at the office that day. And when Gart tries to get some support from her, she treats him like garbage. He tried to tell her about Willoughby, and she tells him that it was her misfortune to marry a man who wants to be Huckleberry Finn. The following day is about the same for him, and he falls asleep on the train once again, only to have the same dream about a stop at Willoughby, Willoughby, except this time he swears he'll get off the next time. So the next day at the office, he has another stressful day, and his own secretary is screaming in his ear. While he's talking to two different phones, he proceeds to lose it and smashes a mirror. He calls his wife for support, and she hangs up on him. Wonderful, wonderful woman. So he's on the train that evening and falls asleep. The conductor yells, Willoughby! Willoughby! And Gart decides to get off. The conductor waves him outside of the train. Gart gets off and has a pleasant conversation with two young boys who call him by name and other townspeople who also welcome him. Well, okay, yeah, he was now in a serene and wonderful environment, but he paid a big price. But then again, I wonder if he really did. Did he pay a big price? He actually jumped from the train to his death. Okay, he jumped to his death, but was death actually better than life? He was living a horrible life. The surprise ending? The funeral home's truck said, Willoughby and Sons Funeral Home. Now, I sure never saw that one coming. I have always loved this episode. It's one of the most memorable Twilight Zone episodes. James Daly was perfect in his role, and Patricia Donahue did a great job playing the pretentious gold-digging wife. And I think most people picture their idea of the perfect life and, you know, wish they could be there. Garth took it one step further, but he had to die in order to get his ideal place. But I gave this episode an excellent rating. I'm actually not sure why I didn't rate it as classic, but it's very, very close to a classic. One reason might be the fact that his secretary, Helen, was screaming in his ear while he was on the phone on two different lines. If I had ever done that to any of my previous bosses, I would have been booted out the door very, very quickly. So Helen was obnoxious in that scene. Anyway, I want to now turn this over to Robert for his review of this episode. Robert.
Thank you, Lynn. Yeah, as a lot of people know, it's very rare that I would give anything a classic. I think the last thing I gave a classic to was Time Enough at Last. But with this one, definitely I rated this a classic. And reason being is a very simple story from the very start to the very end. And it's very well constructed. Wonderful job with the story. You have the daydreamer, like a lot of us are, that want to go somewhere else, tired of our job, just want to just leave it behind and just go to something that's simple. And Garth, played wonderfully by James Daly. A lot of people remember he was in the Medical Center series with Chad Everett.
That's right.
He's a wonderful actor. The boss, the bloated boss, doing his push on him as well, was getting to him. And even his junior executive runs to another ad agency, takes the account with him, so that even makes it more harder on him. And then when he goes home, being batted down by his wife, and you could tell the love has left that marriage a long time ago. He still feels for her, but she's more into the material way of things. And then that one day when he falls asleep on a train on the way home, dreams about Willoughby, kind of like Lynn was saying earlier, like a Huckleberry Finn book type setting. And he decided, well, that's, you know, eventually that's where he wanted to end up at. I loved the twist at the end of the story. And as Lynn mentioned about the scene where Garth jumps from the fence, he doesn't realize he is. But it kind of ties into a couple of movies that I've watched where we could say that this kind of is a time travel, in a sense that maybe we're looking at a sort of astral trajectory where he was able to move his soul from one time to an earlier time. And there was a TV movie called Two Worlds of Jenny Logan back in 1979.
Yeah, you know, I was just thinking about that, Robert, as you were saying that. I was thinking, yeah, he's right. This is just like that movie.
And this one line ties into this story, and this is what I love.
It is possible to break through the barriers of time and space. It is.
And that is towards the end where, Jenny and her husband buys a house, and it's a fixer-upper. The husband ignores her. She finds a dress up in the attic back from the early 1900s, puts it on. She's transferred into the past. And then she falls in love with an artist, and then she decides she wants to stay in the past. At the end, in the little clip that I played, was where the husband finds paintings of her life that the artist did of her. And that was the one, my favorite line, where she mentions you can break the barrier of space and time. A year later, another movie came out, which I love, and here's a little clip of that.
Come back to me.
Oh, somewhere in time!
Richard Collier is about to begin an incredible journey into another realm, another lifetime, in search of the love he could never find in this one.
Somewhere in time.
That's Elise McKenna.
Starred in a play in the hotel theater.
When was this play done?
1912.
Dr. Finney.
Is time travel possible?
That is a question.
Arthur? Arthur? You're the only one who can help me.
Trust!
As Lynn said, a
Robert,
beautiful 1980 movie.
That is one of my all-time favorite movies.
It is mine,
in time.
Too. Somewhere in time.
Oh, my God. As soon as she...
I have that movie, too, actually.
Oh, my God. As soon as I heard Come Back to Me, I knew what it was. Oh, my God.
Jane Seymour and Christopher Reeve.
And Christopher Reeve, yes.
Yep.
Oh, my God. One of the greatest movies of all time. Yeah.
So there, there is two of my movies that I tie into this episode, and... Like I said, A Stop at Willoughby, one of my wonderful episodes that I enjoy, 5 out of 5. I give it a classic. And I'm glad I was able to play those clips for you because I knew a lot of people would have remembered those movies. So I'll pass.
Thank you, Robert. Yes,
oh, no problem. I'll pass it on to Ken. Ken, have you fell asleep and dreamed about that one Orion slave girl? From Star Trek, and wish you were there.
You mean
Susan
Oliver?
Yeah.
Oh, I've had many, many dreams.
Oh, he dreams
that
every night.
I've had a dream on the train. I've had a dream on the airplane. I've had a dream on the cruise ship. I've had a dream while I'm working. So, yes, I've had many, many Willoughbys. And I'm glad... Robert, you have finally seen the light and finally given a classic rating to a Twilight Zone episode in the first season. So I want to congratulate you, Robert. So
well, there's not much left besides another favorite of mine, which is The After Hours coming up. But go ahead.
But I, you know what, Robert? I'm going to have to agree with you, and I did give a classic rating to this one. And I wrote a very extensive review in our book. So, again, I want to plug our book, Twilight Zone Revisited and Reviewed, Volume 1, is available at Amazon.com. So you can read my extensive review in there. And if I write a long review, that means I like it. And there's many things to say about this episode. For me, it just works. The pace of the story works, the characters, the ending. There was one little thing I would have done to change the story because you have two almost situations where, he gets off the train. He almost does and then wakes up, and it's a snowy winter night. But then the third time when he gets off, I would have liked to have seen more of Willoughby extended. Because when he gets off, he kind of starts strolling. He talks to the little boy with the fishing poles. But then after that, I would like to have seen him stroll in the park, talk to a lady, go into the saloon, maybe go into the hotel, maybe stroll along in the grass. So maybe just a little bit more would have worked for me. But all in all, I like the way the story is presented. You know, you have... the guy at work, and obviously he's having a hard time at work. His boss is a bother. He comes home. His wife is nagging him. He's on the train, and I like the contrast with the episode because on the train, it's a snowy winter night as he looks out the window. It's dark. It's snowy. It's winter. But when he dozes off into his dream, and then he meets that conductor. The conductor is gentle, has a nice face, and all he says is, Willoughby. And the guy, when he looks out the window, you have a contrast. It's not snowy and winter and dark, but it's a glorious summer day with the sun shining and people strolling in the park. The grass is green. Even though it's a black and white episode we're watching, you can just picture that. It's just a glorious day in the park. So I like that contrast. And then as the episode develops, the guy, he's almost had it. And I can identify with the guy because I'm a small business owner And I've been working 35 years in the same job. And believe me, there are many Monday mornings and many Friday afternoons where I've just had it. You know, it's the same old, same old. I do landscape gardening, so I get nagging customers. I get difficult situations on my job. And I know how this guy feels. You know, sometimes you just get to a point where you just want to go to the park, you know, get up on top of a bench and just relax and just daydream. And that's why the episode works for me, because really, everybody in this world, they have their own Willoughby. You know, whether it's the theater, the opera, going to a concert, going to a sporting event, or if someone just likes to read books. I have a customer. All he does is read books all day long. I go to his house. He's in his living room. He's got stacks of books next to his chair.
It sounds like the guy from Time Enough at Last.
Yeah.
That's right.
But that's his Willoughby. His Willoughby is reading. And I have a sister. Actually, I have many sisters. And I know exactly what their Willoughby is. One of my older sister, her Willoughby is to spend all day with her grandchildren and take them to the amusement park. That's her Willoughby. I have another sister. She loves the beach. She moved to Florida. She lives in Jacksonville, Florida, right on the beach. And her Willoughby is just to go down by the water and by the sand and just relax and look at the ocean. You know, and you have other people, you know, whether it's music, you know, art. Some people will go to the art museum. They love that. Drama. Some people love to travel. We all have our Willoughby. My Willoughby, and I wrote this in our book, is it's the summer of 1962, guys. Just imagine. I'm 8 years old. I get all my buddies, and we go over to the sand lot. And what do? We get our baseball bats and our gloves. And we get five guys on each side, and we just play baseball at 8 a.m., and we just play in the sandlot all day long until 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock when it gets dark. That's my Willoughby, and there's no problems. You know, I've hit 10 home runs. I have 16 doubles. I have 32 triples and 55 singles. So talk about hitting for the cycle.
I think I'm going to cry.
Hey, this other guy must have been pretty bad.
Never left that body.
So the end scene of Willoughby, where you have the Willoughby and Sons on the funeral home or the big long car that's supposed to pick him up, that's all right. You know, a little twist ending, fine. But to me, Rod Serling, you could have made this episode just a little bit better for me, and that is, let's see Willoughby extended, and maybe even have the wife, you know, the guy's wife, show up in Willoughby, and she's not nagging anymore. Maybe have
he deserves a much nicer wife than her. No. Somebody completely different. Bring Susan Oliver in.
Okay, and then
have Tina show up. How about that? In wearing
Tina, okay.
800 clothes.
All right, anyway, I can go on and on and on, but definitely 5, a classic for me, and if it comes on the Twilight Zone marathon, believe me, guys, I will not
always
be bored. I'll watch it again. So I'm going to pass it along to Kelly. Kelly, you're up.
Okay. Well, I gave this one a 5 rating because I remember when I first saw it in my teens, I was totally blown away by the ending. I mean, I was just not expecting to see it end where we were going to see his dead body in the snow because he committed suicide. I was expecting an ending more of like where he would just disappear and you'd see people trying to find him. You know, I expected to see maybe a scene where you'd see his wife calling the office to see if he was still there, and they'd be saying, no, he left hours ago. You'd see the conductor on the train saying, well, I remember seeing him on the train, but I don't remember seeing him leave the train. I was expecting something a little more like that for the end. The funeral home hearse was definitely a nice added touch. That was just totally bizarre. In fact, when I think of all of the episodes that I've ever seen of the Twilight Zone, I think this one stands out the most for the shocking endings. I mean, I can't recall another Twilight Zone where I was that surprised by the ending.
Definitely. Yeah.
I liked this episode a lot. And, boy, when I was watching it recently and I saw the nagging secretary, I found her more annoying than the wife. Because I thought, well, what kind of a secretary is this? Secretaries are supposed to assist their bosses, not go in and interrupt them on the phone. I mean, what kind of a secretary is that? Most secretaries would get fired for doing something like that. Secretaries, I remember somebody saying once that if you ever wanted anything done, make friends with the secretaries, because it's the secretaries who had the power, you know, because they're the ones that'll get you the appointments with who you need. And she was a very crappy secretary. I mean, any normal secretary worth her salt.
She was obnoxious.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, any normal secretary worth her salt, you know, even if it is Gart's boss, I mean, she would say...
Right.
You know, I'm really sorry, but you know what? He's currently on the phone with two important clients. I mean, you'd think the boss would be thrilled to hear he was on the phone with two important clients, not sitting there telling her, well, go in and tell him to hang up on both of them because I want him to get his ass in here immediately. No. I mean, that's a terrible secretary.
Exactly.
So yeah, I would have liked to have actually seen him tell her that she was fired before he walked out the door. I would have liked to have seen him say, write yourself a resume and a cover letter because you're fired, and then, by the way, I quit.
I would have been fired. I would have been fired for doing something like that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And so, yeah, I liked this, but I really did like this. And I have seen both of those movies that Robert mentioned. And it was funny when he started talking about the how the person died to transcend themselves into another time. I immediately thought of that movie, The Two Worlds of Jenny Logan.
Excellent movie, definitely.
Yeah, and I remember when that movie was on. I liked it a lot. And, you know, and I liked the movie Somewhere in Time, too. I actually owned that movie.
Oh, my God. That is one of my all-time favorite
movies.
I
think it's more of a chick's flick, though, because I remember I watched it with my husband, and we got to the end of it, and he looks at me, and he goes, what, after all of that, that's what happened?
Christopher Lee was a wonderful actor, and it's his pre-Superman going into this movie anyway, so...
That's right.
No, actually, yeah. I think this was after the first Superman movie.
Was it? Okay.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think
that.
It was after the first one.
Are you
one.
Sure? Because I remember seeing that in a posted... I went to a movie theater, and I saw that, movie... being posted on the marquee is what I was trying to find.
Yeah,
the marquee.
Yeah, but it was.
But are you
but
sure?
But I'm pretty sure it was after the first Superman movie, but before the second one.
Wow.
So because the first Superman movie was really the movie that launched his film career, and that was after, and it was after that you started seeing him in all of these various other movies.
And Jane Seymour too. She was wonderful, especially in Live and Let Die.
She was
where
actually
she
one
first
of the
appeared.
Most beautiful women in the world. She was so stunningly beautiful.
Yeah, but this episode Willoughby, I thought was very well done, and I really don't have anything to complain about with it. I think it's definitely one of those Twilight Zone episodes that delivered, from my viewpoint, on all levels. So on that note, I'll turn it over to Bob.
Thank you, Kelly. I only have one question about this episode. Why is it always snowing outside when he's on the train? Because shouldn't there be about 400 inches
of
snow piles up outside by now? It's very bizarre. How do you go in and bang your hand into a mirror and not cut your hand? It's amazing. But those are just minor issues, actually. I think that this is. I did not give it a classic rating only because I'm very tough about that. I don't just hand out classic ratings to nothing, but it is interesting. I think, I was only 13 years old when I saw it, and I think the older you are, the more you can appreciate it. Because if you're only 13 years old or younger, you don't know what it's like to go to work and be hassled and have a million things on your mind. and get into that position. So I don't know that I really understood when I first saw it why he was as upset as he was. It didn't really come home to me. But being older now, being about 16 now, I actually can understand it better than I could in those days. It is an outstanding episode, and what's really good about it, I think, is the simplicity of it all. It's a very simple story. There's no great special effects in it. It's not science fiction. Well, not really. And it's just that, you know. So it's a kind of a simple story, and yet it has some meaning to it. I disagree with Ken. I really did not want to see him roaming around the town, because it's supposed to be in his imagination. And if you show me him roaming around the town, I'm going to wonder whether or not there really is a Willoughby. He really got off there. It just mixes up the story. I think it's better that he never quite gets in there. It's not for us to see. It's for him to imagine, and his way of getting out of this hideous predicament that he's in. And in my review on the board about this episode, I pointed out something interesting, and that is that Rod Serling wrote this story, as he did many of the Twilight Zone stories, and it may be not quite the fiction that it appears to be, because Rod Serling was a very driven man himself. He was really a workaholic. He had bad health. He had several heart attacks. He had a family history of bad heart attacks. He was a chain smoker. He burned the candle at both ends, so to speak, and he really was asking for trouble. And he died at the age of 50 during open heart surgery. And in a book called The Twilight Zone by Martin Grahams, he points out that the train trip that James Daly's taking here is very close to a real train trip that Rod Serling took in his earliest days of being a screenwriter. And he commuted from Ohio to New York on a train that actually went through a town called Willoughby. So he may have remembered that, and he may have been going through the exact same thing and wishing that he could get off and get out of where he was. I mean, I think he was a genius. But, I mean, when you even look at Rod Serling when he shows up in stories, you get the feeling, I always did, that he's kind of nervous and he's got a lot going on. So I think this character is probably as close to Rod Serling's real life as you'll ever see in any of the stories. And in a way, I think he may have been, this may have been a way for him to vent about his own harried life and the fact that he was as busy. He was great success. But just like the character in the story, success sometimes brings with it a lot of trouble. And it did for him, and it certainly eventually it cost him his life. I have a thought-provoking question to ask everybody, and actually Lynn touched on it during her summary, and Kelly and I talked about it briefly before the show, which is that I'm personally not a proponent of suicide as an answer to problems, because all that does is put you in the ground. But given the fact that his lifestyle is so hideous and everybody's beating on him, is this a happy ending or a sad ending? I mean, which is it, or is it both?
I say it's a happy ending.
He's better off dead than he was alive.
Oh, yeah. If you have to live your life that miserable, if you have to be that miserable with your job and your wife and your or husband, if it were reversed, yeah, I think it's a happy ending, because the guy was virtually he was miserable. I mean, he hated his life. So if you hate, okay, all right, I'm not saying that suicide or ending your life is the answer to all of that. But to me, sometimes maybe being dead is better than what you're dealing with in life.
What about other people in real life who, what about women and famous movie stars and people like that who take pill overdoses? I mean, is that okay too? Because they were,
is it okay for him but not for
other people? What's the story?
Well, not unless they have a way to turn it around. And I'm looking at Gart. Okay, he could have turned around. He could have divorced his wife.
Mm-hmm.
He could have, but she would have taken
job.
Him forever. Yeah, he could have quit his job, and if he had divorced his wife, she was a bitch. I mean, she would have taken him for everything. So he would have been penniless, without a job. I don't know. I mean, I don't know.
Well,
I don't know. It's a very tough question.
It kind of depends on whether or not you believe in a life after death. Some people do, some people don't. If you believe that there's somewhere to go after you die, yeah, then maybe he's better off. But, you know, if you believe that you simply go into the ground and that's it, then that's not a very optimistic ending. I'd like to know from Robert and Ken, what do you feel about this? You feel it was an optimistic or a pessimistic ending?
Go ahead, Ken. I'll answer it to you.
I think it's a happy ending. I agree with Lynn on this. I think as he was dreaming, he probably slept walk and got over by the car and then just kind of fell off. I don't know if it was intentional suicide or not.
Yeah, that's actually one way of looking at it, because you're right. He could have just, you know, he could have transcended his mind back to Willoughby, and, you know, and even though he was seeing everything from the perspective of the 1800s, it could very well be that he was actually still on the regular train that he was on, but he was seeing everything else because, as Robert put it, he had transcended his mind to that other place. So yeah, you know what, you bring up a good point. He may not have intentionally committed suicide. It may have been that he really thought he was at Willoughby, and
I don't think he actually wanted to die. I don't think it was his intention to die. I think he just wanted to go off to a place where he could be serene and happy and have some solitude.
Okay, but it doesn't matter whether it was deliberate or not. The fact of the matter is that if he stepped off the train because he was delusional and thought he was in Willoughby, he's still dead one way or the other. And
true,
you have to wonder.
He didn't know he was dead. He didn't know he was going to die.
What it needs to be is it an intention to kill oneself. And I agree with Kelly. I think once his soul left his body, or his understanding, or his conscience, he didn't know where he was after that, and just ran off the train. I think suicide is more intentional. If you are intended on taking your very life, it shows in this episode that he wasn't intent on, he thought of it, especially about the razor boy that he tells his secretary in the beginning. But also it brings up another question on top of what Bobby asked too. Did he transfer his whole self into a physical being back then, or did he connect to a relative during that time and transferred his essence into his relative that was living in that time? Kind of like the Quantum Leap World War episode where Sam leaps into his grandfather. There's
I don't know.
That's, too.
That's too deep for me. I can't go there. I don't know. I can't. That's beyond me. Well, anyway, it's just. I think you can take it either way. So, the reason I bring this up is because whenever we hear about anybody committing suicide, especially somebody in Hollywood, a movie star, whether it's Marilyn Monroe or anybody recent, and you think, why would you do that? Why would you take a pill overdose? You had everything. You had the money. You had the fame. You had everything. And we always shake our heads and go, what a stupid thing to do. I mean, I've done that dozens of times. What a ridiculous thing to do. You had everything you ever wanted and you worked for, and then you went ahead and killed yourself. But if the next time you hear about that, and we surely will again at some point, you ought to think about this story and about whether or not that person might just be better off having done it instead of going through what they were going through. And I think Rod Serling, really, I think this is a story, because I've read a lot of books about him. And he really, really did. He really, really was a workaholic. He really went too far, not just with the Twilight Zone, but as I mean, he was a brilliant man. But you know what? It's really smart to kill yourself over it. And I think this. I don't think he was just riding the train and realized one day, oh yeah, I used to go through a town called Willoughby. I think that he may have been. We'll never know, of course, because apparently he never confided in anybody. But I think there's a little bit of him in this story, and success can come back to bite you. It can be, if you're too successful, it can really ruin your life. So my own personal feelings is that it's neither here nor there. I can't really say if it's a pessimistic ending or not, because it doesn't involve me. It's just up to him. If he thought he was better off dead and he couldn't stay in his life anymore, then maybe that was a good idea. But I don't know. Suicide, if indeed it was that, even if it wasn't, even if he stepped off the train because he actually believed he was in Willoughby, it's still kind of sad. And one more thing I want to say about it: it is a shocking ending. But the thing that makes it really, there are a lot of twist endings in Twilight Zone, as everybody knows. But the twist ending is that even after we see that he's jumped off the train intentionally or not, when they close the doors of the hearse and it says Willoughby on it. So that's one of those unusual Twilight Zone episodes.
That was the total clincher for me.
Right, it goes just a little bit further because you sit there and you go, oh, I see, now I get it, you fooled me again. And then Sterling says, no, not quite, I've got something else to fool you with, too. And he throws it in there. So that's kind of an interesting little twist, which I think, you know, pushes it a little bit past the other episodes. I gave it a 4. It could be 4 or 5. It's either one. I mean, in our ratings, the difference between 4 and 5 is marginal.
Yep.
Excellent, classic,
well,
whatever it is.
Well, I want to hear what Dave thinks. Dave, are you still there?
I certainly am. I'm biking.
Yes, darling. What do you think?
Well, lots of things. I certainly don't think it was suicide. I think he was completely enamoured with the place. This was his escape route. It was a place that he yearned to be. It was an exit that he wanted. And I'm going to be a little bit controversial because a few weeks back when we were on season 1, episode 23, I quite liked the story called A World of Difference, which was about a very similar guy who was in this role and... you know, suddenly the fourth wall goes away and he's not in an office, but they're actually filming a set and his wife wants to divorce him and he was trapped in the very same way and he went off into a world of his own through the
Jerry.
Script that was on... Right, so this to me was very much a reworking of that, but having said that, much better... conceived idea of the plot, and I did really like it. When I watched it just again recently, I had a slight bit of a criticism that I've now worked out in my own mind isn't a criticism, because I thought, well, this is a fairly light and short story, and they had these repeat things on the train, which seemed to me sort of be a little bit of padding of, rerunning the same material 2 or 3 times. And like when he looks out of the train into this beautiful summer's day at this Willoughby, you know, the same events seem to be going on. And then these thoughts crossed my mind. In actual fact, it's the same day each time he gets to Willoughby. It's that one summer ideal day. The boys have gone fishing for catfish or whatever it is. The elderly couple are strolling towards the bandstand. The second time we see the same couple strolling towards the bandstand.
It's like the 1920s. Yeah.
Even earlier. But the whole point is, I was thinking, well, that's a bit cheap. They've reused the same footage. But I think that works in as much as... basically, it was the same day, and if he did actually arrive at Willoughby, he wasn't going to live out his life for 20 years and grow older. He was basically going to live that one ideal day that is the dream that he said. I mean, like Ken mentioned about his sister's different dreams, I've got a young cousin, and Ken will probably be, he'll probably go up with a moan about this, because of course he says he's a landscape gardener. He wants to give up his high pressure job, and he wants to do what's called in the UK dry stone walling. That's where you build walls with stones, but you build them together, you don't put any mortar in it or anything, and the walls are in fields that the farmers use. But it's supposed to be a very therapeutic thing to do that. You might only build about 5 or 6 yards of wall a day, but, you know, it's basically a jigsaw puzzle, and it's supposed to be so consuming of your mental powers that basically all the worries of the day would drift off you. It's physically demanding, very satisfying, and his idea of Willoughby is to be a dry stone waller. But I'm sure a landscape gardener would think, oh my God, I can't think of anything worse than that. Hard landscaping, that's the word.
Hey, Dave?
Yep.
Maybe it was one point in time that he kept hitting, and it just stayed in that one point, kind of like a Casalis loop or something, where it's a day that's repeated over and over again.
Well, that's again, where, I mean, I don't think he committed suicide at all, but the point is that when we find out, and the big reveal, it certainly was a big reveal, when he's on that snow-laden ground, and of course that works because of the very experience that we've had. They've had like a fortnight of blizzards, you know, with this man going home from work and each day it's snowing. So I think that actually works on that level. And there's... two other things I want to mention. I like the scene with the mirror. Now, I realise, quite rightly, you know, you would have thought he would have really cut his hand up. But how well was that done, in as much as, you know, you can stand an awful lot. You can stand the abuse of his boss saying, push, 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 and he stand all that. But when he goes into the bathroom, he's washing his hands, washing his face, he brings his face up to the mirror, he can't stand the sight of his own face. It's only when he looks himself in the eyes that he realises he's reached this snapping point. And I thought that was a very well realised scene. And one more thing, and I'm not going to be spoiler, but I know there's a few people in the room now. I thought the idea of this where, you know, he does die, but in those moments, from throwing himself off the train, he thinks into Willoughby, and maybe, you know, they say it takes a couple of minutes for your, you know, your brain to be starved of oxygen and you to die. It reminded me of the BBC series that was here in the UK a few years ago, and that's Life on Mars.
Mars,
I'm not going to
give
any spoilers away, but that really made me think of that series. And if there's anybody in the room who wants to know about that, I can perhaps mention it after the recording ends, so I don't want to spoil it. And one last thing, you talked about the that Stitch in Time, the film. I haven't seen it.
Dave, can you send me the link to that?
The Life on Mars?
Yeah.
I will certainly put it in the room in a minute. But I think Robert's likely to know. What about that film that's just aired this last year called The Time Traveller's Wife? Has that got any similar plot characteristics to it?
I hadn't seen that yet, Dave, so I can't comment on it.
Well, perhaps somebody in the room. But, yeah, I would say it was a classic one, but I do feel as though people who were a bit scathing of The World of Difference and that Season 1, Episode 23, might like to think, well, perhaps that had some merits itself.
I loved The World of Difference, and I was one of the few people who gave that a classic, only because, oh, thank you, Dave, thank you for the link. But I gave World of Difference a classic only because it was the only episode that Rod Serling actually showed up at the end of the series and played himself. And I love that. I know that that's not the greatest reason in the world to give something a classic, but did Rod Serling ever show up as himself? Did he ever play himself in an episode? No. So this was very... unbelievable to me that Rod Serling was there. He showed up. He was part of the show. I part of the episode. I just loved it.
And can I just say one piece of trivia before I finish?
Anything.
The actor who played him, the main character, I was only watching him on TV yesterday because here in the UK on CBS Action, they're re-showing the original Star Trek series, and he played Methuselah
Bailey, yeah.
in Requiem for Methuselah. And he played an excellent part there as a sort of slightly weird, world-weary character. However, in this character, he'd lived 6,000 years.
Wow. Oh,
right, he had a daughter in that episode and stuff. Yeah, that's a good episode.
Well, I won't say it wasn't his daughter, but I won't say what it was because that would spoil the story.
Right.
I wouldn't mind living 2,000 years, but I don't know about 6,000 years. I'm not sure about that. But 2,000, yeah, I could live 2,000.
Well, like I said, this is one of my favorite stories, and... another question is, what makes it different from the past stories where we have similar themes to this? Why did this one work where the other ones have failed?
Well, which ones are you talking about?
Well, like the one where the one guy goes back in time to when he was a kid.
Oh, yeah, Walking Distance.
Right.
Yeah, but see, he wasn't trying to go back to his childhood. Gart was not trying to go back to his childhood. He just wanted to get out of the lousy life he was living. So that's the difference there. In Walking Distance, he definitely... Walking Distance, Gig Young, who played the star in that, he wanted to go back to... He actually didn't want to go back to his childhood, but he ended up there. So in this one, with Gart, he didn't want to go back to his childhood either. He just wanted to get out of his lousy stinking life that he was in. You know, his life, it stinks. It stinks. You know, it stinks. You know, so he wanted to get out of there. And he got out. But at a price.
Right. Pretty much just escape reality where, you know, we had some past episodes where, you know, characters wanted to escape reality.
Mm-hmm.
But I think
this
was a well done episode.
Mm-hmm. Well, 16 millimeter with Ida Lupino. She wanted to escape into her past. And she ended up going back to her past in the films. You know, she brought herself back into the film that she was watching, and that was pretty disturbing that she was able to go in. That was disturbing, but I can see your point there. Yeah,
there was a one where Rock does appear in kind of a comedy skit thing with Jack Benny.
Oh, and that's great. Isn't that awesome?
That
yeah,
one is
I
on YouTube.
That.
Yeah, that is.
I love that. Yeah, I love that. So, Bobby, you have anything else to say?
No, I think we've probably pretty much done it to death, actually.
Oh, okay. Kelly, Ken, anything?
Well, I wanted to ask Bob.
Yeah.
Why he doesn't want to see the pretty girls strolling along Willoughby?
Well, because it's more mysterious if it's only in his own mind.
Well, it's not like it's the 1800s. It's not like they're going to be walking around in bikinis, so who cares?
But, Bob, really, you got to elaborate a little bit more. Why don't you want to see an extended Willoughby again?
I don't need to see it. This is something
I don't need to see it either, Ken. I thought what we saw was more than sufficient.
It's in his imagination. It's not up to me to know that. It's more mysterious if you don't know whether it really exists or not. It's only in his imagination. And then seeing the town takes away from it. That's all. It's as simple as that.
They did tease us a little bit by showing the two fishing, the boys with the fishing poles. Now, that was a little taste. Now, do you think they should have done away with that?
No, that didn't bother me.
No, but they did show a little bit. I mean, you saw some people in the distance, and you saw a band playing under a gazebo.
Yeah.
I think the same, you know, it was brought up that it was the same day, and I think it was supposed to be the 4th of July, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I'm sure it was the same day. One thing we haven't mentioned is...
It actually, to a certain degree, reminded me of that song by Chicago called Saturday in the Park, Every Day's the 4th of July.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Bart found it.
One thing we didn't mention is the fact that the postmaster or whatever he was sitting on the wagon with the horses, they knew his name as well, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yes, it was
you're right.
He already had a place there, and everybody knew him.
Yeah. For me, do away with the office scene. You don't need to elaborate there. You don't need to elaborate with the nagging wife. The whole point of the episode is the guy's imagination in another time that what his Willoughby is. All I wanted was to see a little bit more, you know. That's all.
Yeah, but it was such a light story. You couldn't really have taken in much more away. Otherwise, the story would have only been 15 minutes long.
It wouldn't have been an hour. There's no way. I think that was the right... 22 minutes was the right time for this episode.
Oh, yeah, they couldn't have done an hour on this. No.
Nah.
They couldn't have done an hour on this.
Yeah.
Absolutely not. Okay, well, I think we have done this. Anybody else have anything to say?
Well, next week, show, Lynn, I'm looking in our book. It says The Chaser. Now, I can't believe we're going to talk 45 minutes.
No, not at all.
No, we're just going to let you talk 45 minutes about it. We're not going to say anything.
We could probably do two episodes.
Well, I think we're going to let you open
time.
That one again. Yeah.
No, you take care of that one.
What are we doing for the next show so people know?
I don't know, but you better think it over because it's all on you.
It's on me?
You got it.
Well, maybe we should talk about The Chaser and the one that comes after it.
Yeah, I agree.
What's
the
one that comes after the
chaser?
I am looking it up now.
Looking at the book too. Let me see. A Passage for the Trumpet.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
right. Jack
definitely.
Klugman. Okay, all right. I can deal with that one. All right.
I don't know about that. Well, don't ask me. I only created the group.
We can spend 5 minutes talking about the chaser and the rest of the time talking about the other one.
Don't ask me my opinion. I only created the group. I have no input, so. Okay.
I'm sorry. I won't be on the show next time. One of my friends is having his 60th birthday celebration, so we're going to a hotel so we can wine and dine and not have to drive.
And get drunk. Oh, my goodness.
Well,
oh,
Dave, if you want to send me a MP3, and I can try to put it on the next show, if you want to do it that way. You got my email.
If I can get around to it, I certainly will, yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, okay, that's okay, Dave, but the next one's nothing to even get excited about anyway, so don't worry about it. But, okay, well, everybody, thank you for being here tonight. I am so thrilled that all of you are here. And I thank everybody. Let me see, who do we have here? Crimson Ring Box, and we had Bookhouse Boy, and Lucid, and all of you. Oh, thank you so much, all of you, for being here tonight. And we will see you in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks. Bye, Lynn. Bye, Dave. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Bye, all.
Bye.